Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Feels like every week a foreign company is taking over an Australian one, or there are plans afoot for it to happen. You probably recall the fuss over infant formula group Bellamy's Australia, which last year was taken over by a Chinese dairy company in what was a $1.5 billion deal. Plenty of people said, why are we allowing that to happen? Or should it have happened? More recently, we've seen Canada's Alimentation Couche-Tard make a $8.8 billion bid for Caltex Australia. Japanese brewer Asahi is keen to make a $16 billion acquisition of Carlton and United Breweries. And then there was the fuss, wasn't there, of the takeover of the Port of Darwin on a long-term lease by Chinese interests as well. While the final decision as to whether these investments happen is made by the Federal Treasurer, it is Australia's Foreign Investment Review Board, or FIRB, which provides advice on whether or not it's in the national interest. In its most recent annual report, 2017-18, the board approved around 11,000 proposed transactions worth around $163 billion. The overwhelming majority of them were from China and in the real estate sector. There's concern there too, isn't there? FIRB is now run by David Irvine. He was the former boss of Australia's spy agency, ASIO. And there's a view that in recent years the organisation may have pivoted towards taking security interests when recommending takeovers as more of a factor, which includes issues such as protecting the private data, for example, of Australian citizens. Anyway, how does the FIRB recommend what acquisitions should take place and what does it weigh up and do we need it? The process is already heavily regulated. Is it too regulated? Why do companies want to come here anyway? Tonight we're joined by a panel of experts to discuss the ins and outs of the FIRB, and I'd love you to join that conversation or ask a question as well. Deborah Johns is with us. Deborah is a partner in Gilbert and Tobin's Corporate Advisory Group, advising on corporate and commercial transactions. She's also something of an expert on matters relating to the FIRB. Deborah, good evening and welcome to Nightlife.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Terrific to have you with us. Hans Hendrisch is a professor of Chinese business and management at the University of Sydney's Business School. He speaks and writes fluent Chinese, and he's a frequent commentator on China business and Australia-China business relations in national and international media. He and KPMG put out an annual report on Chinese investment in Australia. Hans, wonderful to have you with us as well.
Thank you so much, Philip.
Good evening and welcome to Nightlife. And also joining us is journalist David Uren. David was economics editor of The Australian for a period. He's also the author of Takeover and The Kingdom and The Quarry. And he joins us as well. David, good evening to you and welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening.
Terrific to have all of you with us. Deborah, can we get down to basics? What is the Foreign Investment Review Board? What does it do?
It's a very good question. The Foreign Investment Review Board is just an advisory body. So it and the Secretariat within Treasury collects applications and disseminates them to all the different government agencies that may have an interest in those applications. They solicit advice from all of those agencies, collate it, assess it, and then provide a recommendation to the Treasurer or the Treasurer's delegate on foreign investment applications.
Okay, so it's only a recommendation. It's
Correct.
Not a binding.
Correct.
It's not a binding decision.
Correct.
Do their recommendations normally get followed?
As far as we know, there's no visibility necessarily as to what the precise recommendation is, but most of the time our understanding is that the recommendation is followed.
That's interesting. So it's not even a transparent process.
To some extent, it is not a transparent process.
So you don't know whether the FIRB recommended in favour or not. Is that right?
Well, when we get approval, we assume that they did.
Yeah, but that's interesting. So the FIRB makes a confidential recommendation to government. Is that right?
Essentially, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Is there any reason for that, or why shouldn't there be more? Why shouldn't there be greater transparency in what a taxpayer funded body recommends to government?
I think that the kinds of information that they assess comes from a wide variety of government agencies that has varying degrees of confidentiality. And so the advice that goes to the treasurer is not necessarily a yes or no. It's a here's all of the factors that you should consider in making your decision, and here is the way that we think the decision should be made.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not necessarily a yes or no piece of paper that's going to the treasurer.
But often it's very difficult to work out why something happened or not.
We can usually get a reasonable idea as to what the concerns are that the government has before the recommendation goes to the treasurer, just based on the interaction that we have, the conditions that the government is thinking about imposing on the transaction. So we usually have some idea that there is or isn't an issue and an idea as to what that is, but we often don't know the specific information that's triggered some kind of concern within the government.
What's the bar for this? I mean, if a foreign business wants to buy an Australian company or wants to buy up swathes of, you know, prime agricultural land in Australia as a, from, you know, from an agribusiness point of view, what's the bar? Is it above a certain monetary value or?
So the bar depends on what the transaction is and who the acquirer is.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're a foreign government investor or if you're deemed to be a foreign government investor, then the bar is usually zero and you have to get approval for virtually anything that you would do in Australia.
So if a government wants to buy something here?
A government or a private equity fund that has a lot of public pension fund money in it, those would all have to get approval for virtually anything that they do in Australia.
Even buying a house in
Australia? Especially buying a house.
Yeah,
everybody has to get approval that is a foreign person to buy a house in Australia.
Is that right?
Yes.
So anybody who wants to buy a house in Australia has to get Foreign Investment
Correct.
Review Board.
There's
what
a,
even
there's
if it costs $200,000? Sorry, there
couple,
are no...
couple of exceptions. So if you're buying something for diplomatic or consular purposes, there's an exception. But otherwise, any foreign person who's not a permanent resident or citizen has to get approval.
Okay, that's interesting.
That's why there's 11,000 applications for residential, or about 5,000, a huge number of applications for residential real estate.
Hmm. Okay, but for businesses, you know, an American company, for example, wanted to come here and buy a small technology firm here because they've got an interesting piece of kit that they want, for example. That's common these days. Do they need FIRB approval?
So in those cases, if it's a private investor, then it depends on the value of the business in Australia. And different countries have different value thresholds that are applied to them. So the standard threshold currently is $275 million. So anything below that level, a foreign investor could come in and buy.
Mm-hmm.
Certain investors from treaty countries like the U.S. would enjoy a much higher threshold. So it's over $1 billion currently.
Is there any cultural protection? I mean, what about if companies want to come here and buy Australian film or book publishing companies, for example, which you might think contribute to the cultural life of the country? Is there any higher bar on that?
So there are various different thresholds for different kinds of things. There are some things that are considered to be sensitive businesses, like media businesses, which can be subject to a lower threshold. But generally speaking, not, unless it falls into that sensitive business category.
Who's the biggest foreign investor in Australia?
Well, depends on the statistics. If you look at you have to remember when you're looking at the Foreign Investment Review Board's annual report, what that is reporting is the value of the approvals that they've given, which doesn't necessarily correlate to the value of the investment that's been made.
Hmm.
People may get approvals for things and then the investment doesn't proceed.
I mean, there's a common perception that China is busy buying up Australia. Is that actually true?
There are certainly a lot of applications from Chinese investors. There's also lots of applications from other countries like the US, as you mentioned.
Hans, why are the Chinese interested in Australia and buying Australian companies anyway?
Oh, for a whole range of reasons. In most general terms, it's because the Chinese economy really depends in a number of areas on Australia, and that's largely resources, where Australia provides up to a third of Chinese imports in iron ore, for example. So China for infrastructure building really depends on Australia. Same works for energy, coal, liquid natural gas. All of these are areas where China really needs Australia to supply their demand. That's on a very basic side. And then in a number of consumer industries, China simply relies on Australia for high quality food, for example. All our agricultural produce, wine and so on, are areas where China is very much interested. And then a number of new areas. You mentioned Bellamy before. These are in the healthcare sector, where China, with all these health problems that it has really made.
Well, Bellamy's was infant formula. It's not really healthcare, is it?
No. All right. Yeah. But you have vitamins. You have healthcare products.
Right. Okay. Blackmores and people.
Blackmore,
like that.
Yeah. Where there's strong Chinese interest, as is in healthcare services. So Australia provides a whole range of services which are quite crucial for the domestic market in China.
Deborah, back to you. Is there a greater bar on Chinese companies buying Australian companies? One of the things that the West is very concerned about, Donald Trump keeps telling us this, is that China simply steals Western technology. Is there a greater bar on the Chinese buying things?
So I think that comes in a few different ways. One is China does have a free trade treaty with Australia, and so they do enjoy, the private investors from China would enjoy the higher thresholds on pure business acquisitions. The issue with China is that a huge number of companies are not private investors, and so you see a large number of Chinese applicants having to get approval because they're actually state-owned or have a significant
state. Well, very large rights. Chinese companies are almost invariably connected to the state in some way, aren't they?
Correct. Yeah, yeah. So a lot of those would have to get approval for anything that they buy. On its face, the rules don't discriminate between investors from one country versus another country. So every application would be assessed essentially against similar criteria. I think it is certainly the case that when you go to Canberra and sit down and say, look, we've got a new application, it's a Chinese investor, you can feel the tension go up in the room a little bit.
Really?
Mm-hmm. But the criteria are all the same. It's just the facts that trigger concerns or tend to be more prevalent with Chinese investors in the eyes of the government.
How interested are the Chinese in Australian residential real estate, Hans?
Oh, they are. Well, we don't really have very precise figures, or didn't have until a while ago, but now it is controlled by the Australian Tax Office. They are interested. Chinese are buyers, but they're not bigger than all other major buyers.
Sorry, what do you mean by that?
They're
not the major buyer. They're not the major foreign buyer, you mean? I mean, I imagine China is not bigger than all domestic buyers, for example, but in terms of foreign buyers of Australian residential real estate, are they the largest group or not?
I wouldn't know offhand.
Right.
I know we looked at figures some years ago when Chinese buyers of residential real estate roughly made 2% of the market, of the domestic market, of the total domestic market. So they were not as big as people thought, that they're really buying Australian real estate in very large numbers.
Okay. Let's bring David in here too. David Urin is economics editor of The Australian, author of Takeover and the Kingdom and the Quarry. David, to you, the FIRB is, well, as Deborah says, is merely an advisory body. Does it have any more weight than that, though? Does the Treasurer decide to overrule it, you know, on his or her peril, or what?
Look, there are cases of the Treasurer overruling it. I think that a classic case was when the Joe Hockey ruled that an American company, ADM, would not be allowed to buy GrainCorp. That was a decision that the FIRB had not recommended. I think it was split. Joe Hockey said as much. And there have been a couple of other transactions where, indeed one that Josh Frydenberg made to block a Hong Kong purchase of a large gas pipeline company, APA. I think there was a split FIRB recommendation on that. But to answer your question directly, yes, the FIRB has great weight. It's now chaired by David Irvine, who was formerly the Director General of ASIO and of ASIS, the Australian Secret Intelligence Service. He's also a former ambassador to China. And the other directors, the other members of the Foreign Investment Review Board are all people of very significant reputation, mostly from business. So their recommendations to the Treasury do carry very considerable weight. And I think that David Irvine has made his influence felt by bringing a much tighter focus on issues concerning national security in the which until three or four years ago really didn't carry that much weight in foreign investment appraisals.
How on earth were the Chinese allowed to buy the port of effectively buy it for 100 years anyway, the port of Darwin? I mean, many people are completely puzzled by this, thinking, was this against the recommendation of the FIRB?
Well, no, because it was the lease of a state government asset, it actually didn't require FIRB approval. But the Northern Territory government was aware that there could well be sensitivity over it, so it ran it past the FIRB. It made sure that the Defence Department knew about it, made sure that the intelligence services knew about it. I think the National Security Committee had some consideration about it. And the issue was that the port was for sale. It needed more investment. The Commonwealth was not prepared to invest itself, so the Northern Territory government didn't have the money to upgrade it, so they put it on the market, and this was the result. And it was really only, everybody kind of thought of it, oh, well, you know, Darwin Port, who cares? And it was only once that the deal was done that really alarm bells started ringing.
Hey, I'm amazed that alarm bells didn't ring before. I mean, the Port of Darwin is the major port in the north of Australia. It's clearly of national security interest, isn't it? I mean, heaven's sake, what were these people in Canberra doing? Were they asleep?
Well, the matter was very deeply interrogated in parliamentary committees, as you might imagine. And I think it was Binskin, who was chief of the armed forces at the time, made the comment that he could get a deck chair and sit on the outside the fish and chip shop at the end of the pier and track what boats were coming in and what boats were going out. So having the lease over the port really didn't make very much difference to anything. So defence persisted with its view that it was quite relaxed about it. Dennis Richardson, who, you know, goodness knows, is Secretary of the Department of Defence and a former Secretary of Department of Foreign Affairs and a deeply experienced public service servant, he was expressed great confidence that this was not an issue that would raise concern. And indeed, the operators have, I think, done what they said they would do, or they are doing what they said they'd do. My understanding is in upgrading the port and investing in tourist facilities and, you know, more cruise ships and the like.
Okay, so nothing to see here. David...
But clearly the Americans and others didn't see it that way.
No, I think much of the Australian public doesn't see it that way either. David Jurens with us, Economics Editor of The Australian, formerly. Also Hans Hendrich is with us as well. Deborah Johns from Gilbert and Tobin's Corporate Advisory Group are with us. We're talking about foreign investment in Australia. Just before we go on, so I'd like to put that issue of the Darwin port to Hans. There is a detailed severe thunderstorm warning, by the way, for people in parts of the Blue Mountains, Hawkesbury, Gosford, Wyong and Sydney areas. This warning applies to people in New South Wales. The Bureau of Meteorology has warning that the effects will be from 10:30 right through until for an hour or so. Large hailstones, heavy rainfall, flash flooding and damaging winds are likely. So just make sure that your property is well protected. Hans, back on the Darwin port, as I say, many Australians are quite puzzled by this and thinking, what was the government doing? Were they asleep at the wheel? From your knowledge of what China is interested in Australia, what's your take on the Darwin port deal?
Well, you do have two perspectives. One is what David just explained, the way in which the security services and geostrategic partners looked at that and said, well, that is going to interfere with our operations or with the Marines being stationed in Darwin. You can also see it from a commercial perspective, and then you would have the argument that ports actually are not necessarily a national asset that has to be in state ownership. So you would have ports in Europe, for example, which are private ports or joint venture or state-owned, but there's a degree of flexibility. So it's a commercial question on how you want to run a port. And at that time, of course, when the Chinese bought that 99-year lease of the Port of Darwin, we had just the developing Australia's North policy as part of general considerations on what to do with the Australian North. And the idea was that it would become an agricultural basis. So the Chinese had motives to invest there because they essentially wanted to build up a transport infrastructure. They would have a logistics chain that would run from the Pacific through Darwin back into China or East Asia. So these were the commercial arguments. And what they would put in favour were what, for example, we see in Greece with the port of Piraeus, that in the last 10 years has tenfold increased their turnover and had $1 billion of investment into the port facilities. So the Chinese would have argued they were trying to build up the port of Darwin in a similar way, expanding it, making it part of a major transport route. But, of course, by now the security considerations have taken precedence.
Yes, David, I mean, just back to you, and then I want to go back to Deborah on the criteria that get applied here. But, David, could I ask you, if the application by the Chinese was made today to do this, the decision would be completely different, wouldn't it? I mean, there'd be zero absolutely. Chance that the Chinese would be allowed to do this.
Yeah, absolutely. So pretty much in response to both the Darwin port and a pretty significant embarrassment over the moves to sell Ausgrid to possibly a Chinese bidder, the government set up a critical infrastructure centre, which is built up an inventory of all critical infrastructure in the nation. It advises both government and the FIRB, and it has very significant powers. It can intervene in the management of infrastructure if it believes there are security concerns. So there's been a very strong response, and indeed the appointment of David Irvine to the board and ultimately to chair the Foreign Investment Review Board also, I think, was precipitated in part by the concerns that followed the Darwin port lease.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Deborah, just back to you. What are the criteria that the FIRB apply anyway? I mean, is it that we don't like the look of you, the cut of your jib, or, I mean, are there specific criteria? I mean, if you wanted to buy, for example, a piece of Australia, you know, a company that makes military technology, I presume the answer would be no, unless it was an ally. You know, if you wanted to buy a tech company that was developing new military radar, for example, I imagine the answer would be no. But but it seems okay to buy agricultural land. You could buy dairy farms. You can buy infant formula. You can buy residential real estate. Are there some things you just can't buy?
So there will certainly be some things that there are specific assets that you might look at and say it's highly unlikely that a foreign person would be allowed to buy it. Ausgrid is a perfect example. The government's essentially come out and said no foreign buyers. The concept of national interest is not actually defined in the legislation.
Really?
There is and that's deliberate because any attempt to define it will ultimately leave something out. So not defining it means the government is free to take into account whatever they want when they're assessing whether a transaction is contrary to the national interest. There is a policy which sets out the things that they would typically look at. So national security, impact on competition, impact on the economy, the community, the character of the investor, et cetera. The concept of national security is definitely expanded. When I first moved to Australia in 2002 and started doing this, national security, at least from the outside looking in, appeared to be a very narrow military sense of what is national security, whereas now there's much more expansive view. So when we lodge an application, we address all of those different kinds of criteria. We highlight the sorts of things that the foreign investor will do from a positive perspective. And to the extent there's anything negative about the application, we'll explain it, try to explain how the benefits will outweigh those negative aspects.
Mm. It seems remarkably opaque, doesn't it? So it's really just down to the whim of the treasurer on the day.
It's far more transparent than it used to be. We have much more interaction with FIRB and with the various consulate agencies than we would have 5 years ago. And so we do have some visibility of what's going on. But at the end of the day, it's the treasurer's decision.
How much xenophobia is going on, Hans? A Chinese corporate interest looked upon more negatively because they're Chinese, as opposed to Canadian interests or UK interests?
That's sometimes a view that Chinese investors might hold. But I think what you were just discussing is quite crucial in the sense that what the Foreign Investment Review Board does is not just look at applications and say yes or nay, but they have a process in place which has increased and has become much more elaborate in recent years, that they guide investors. So the approval process, probably the very last bit of a process that goes beforehand, and that would include people like Deborah negotiating with Foreign Investment Review Board on behalf of Chinese clients in regards to, for example, ownership. Should there be Australian ownership? Should they have Australian management? To what degree do they have to localize? To what degree can they sell products in their offtake back to China without control of transfer pricing? So there's a very elaborate process around all that, which essentially is guiding Chinese investors. Mm-hmm. And what they, quite clearly in the case of Chinese investors, what they have learned in recent years is that they have to become much more local than what used to be the case a few years back. So, for example, in agricultural investment, in the end, nearly all investors by now have Australian either partners or Australian management to run their operations. And that is partly simply the learning process. You can't just operate things here as you can in China, but also it's part of the guidance that FIRB gives, or Foreign Investment Review Board, gives to those investors.
Well, in other words, it's doing exactly what China does to foreign investors. That is, it's impossible to invest in China unless you engage a Chinese partner to invest with. You're saying that FIRB is trying to apply similar criteria here?
Well, there's a legal side to it, and there's an applied side, a commercial side to it. The legal side in China actually is not that you cannot invest without a Chinese partner. There are some areas where you need a Chinese partner, but generally, most areas you can, which are open for investment, you can invest as a wholly owned foreign enterprise. But I think what the Foreign Investment Review Board does, which is different from what happens in China, is the guidance they give. So it's not so much that you have to be controlled, but really how do you have to structure your investment if you want to get agreement from the Foreign Investment Review Board.
1-300-800-222. My guests tonight, Deborah Johns, is a partner in Gilbert and Tobin. They're a big law firm, the corporate advisory group. She's an expert on FIRB, the Foreign Investment Review Board. Hans Hendrich is with the University of Sydney Business School, and David Uren, author of Takeover in the Kingdom and the Quarry, and a well-known Australian economics writer. We're talking about foreign investment in Australia, something that often is a bit of a hot button topic for people who are concerned about national sovereignty and all sorts of things. David, just back to you on the, if you've got questions, by the way, 1-300-800-222. Lines are open, 1-300-800-222. David, back to you. There's often popular concern about, for example, the Chinese interest in Victorian dairy farms, for example, because if you look at Australia, there are some areas of Australia which are prime areas, and the Chinese investment in there has been of concern to some people. Then, mind you, others say, well, thank heavens for the Chinese, because who else is going to invest in them in Australia? Do you think some of this concern that the Chinese might be wanting to invest in prime agricultural real estate, for example, is warranted?
Well, it was something that Barnaby Joyce made quite a significant song and dance about. I think he used to say that we'd be better off selling the Sydney Opera House to the Chinese than prime agricultural land. I think it was one of his lines. I remember that when Xi Jinping came to Australia and he spoke to Parliament, this was in 2014, he took a huge trade delegation to Tasmania, and there was quite a significant level of Chinese investment went into Tasmania, into its agriculture, into various tourism industries as a direct result of this. And this caused a hue and cry. I think Alan Jones on radio in Sydney thought that this was a terrible thing. And Chinese investment in Tasmania, building tourist facilities, I mean, ultimately foreign investment is a good thing. It's creating jobs, it's expanding opportunities. We have an important, China's our most important trading partner. Investment links are a good marriage to trade. Our agriculture wants to sell, so I think there is xenophobia that I think runs a bit riot in this area. But it has ever been thus. When the Japanese started investing in the tourism industry in Australia in the 1980s, there was a lot of nationalist objection, particularly in Queensland, to all these terrible Japanese honeymooners who were coming to Queensland and spending lots of money.
Yeah, look, I'm glad you made that point, because that is true. I mean, foreign investment's always been important for Australia. We've never had the capacity to raise all the capital needed for investment in Australia. And also, we can't have it both ways, can we? We can't close off the pipe for foreign investment here and yet want it for Australian companies wishing to invest elsewhere. Either, I suppose it's the scope and type of it. 1-300-800-222. How many loopholes are there, Deborah? I mean, why can't a foreign company simply set up a $2 shelf company in Australia and buy it that way?
Well, because an Australian company that's owned by foreigners would still be deemed to be foreign, okay. So they're still going to be subject to the laws, even if they're incorporated here.
Okay, so
it's not that easy.
it's not that easy. Let's take a call or two. Steve's on the line. Hi, Steve.
Yeah, g'day, Philip. G'day, distinguished guests. I hope you're all well and happy.
We are.
Look, this foreign investment, look, I think it's fine, but there's got to be regulations in place to protect Australian national security and protect Australian citizens. Since this whole thing started, I'm seeing the massive rise of inequality, the sell-off of our electricity grids, the sell-off of water. Our electricity is skyrocketing. Rents are skyrocketing. Home...
What you're saying, this is a direct result of foreign investment.
Skyrocketing. And I'll give you a classic. The other night on SBS, Mr. John Pilger, the Australian author and filmmaker, did a documentary called The Secret War on the National Health Service. It's done in Britain, and no doubt it's underway here in Australia. When is this Foreign Investment Review Board going to ensure the security of ordinary hard-working mums and dads and nans and pops, that they're going to have job security once again? We're seeing all our major industries go offshore. And I think I mentioned to you a book on free trade, How to Kill a Country, by Professor Linda Weiss, which everyone wants to ignore. I hear a lot of these big multinationals don't even pay proper tax in Australia.
Yeah, okay. Let's put some of that back to the panel as well. I mean, that's always been a concern, hasn't it, David, that foreign companies come here and through transfer pricing arrangements, et cetera, arrange their affairs so that, all the bills get paid somewhere else. People have seen it with Uber, companies like Uber, for example, where the billing seems to be in Dublin, for heaven's sake. Is that a legitimate concern or not?
Look, I think how you tax global companies has been a concern going back to the 1920s, really, since the birth of global companies. So, yes, there are issues. The Australian Tax Office and the government have been passing an awful lot of legislation to force, for example, in the case you mentioned, digital companies to structure their operations in Australia, to book their sales through Australia. So there's an awful lot of legislative work going on in that area. There's a lot of work going on at the OECD as well, trying to coordinate international efforts. And to some extent, the Trump administration's tax package that came into effect at the beginning of 2018, that makes a bit of a difference to the way in which multinationals operate because they no longer have incentives to try and minimise the US tax they're paying because the US no longer taxes what they earn around the world. So companies are really going to be much more focused on the individual tax regimes of the individual countries in which they operate.
Okay. Let's take another call. Eric, hello.
Hello, Philip.
Hi, Eric.
How are you?
Well, thank you.
Philip, I have no issue with foreign investment at all. I quite invite it. I like the idea of the way the Foreign Investment Review Board looks at certain national security ticks and balances. But there's been a lot of scaremongering from politicians on various sides of the divide that seem to think that if people come to this country with as foreign investors, they're going to dig the dirt up and take it home in a suitcase.
Mm-hmm.
That is, I believe, scaremongering. Now, the word that we're missing here and the whole crux of it is investment. These companies are coming in from overseas or from outside Australia to make a profit and a return. With that money, they are leaving a legacy of advancement. And coming from an agricultural background, I've seen this a lot in agriculture and even over the last 150 years, if it wasn't for certain nationalities in certain regions of Australia, quite possibly we could still be a desert, like Esperance, the Western Kimberleys, the VRD.
Correct. If it wasn't for UK investment in the northern half of Australia, nothing much might have happened.
We're looking at it now with that superannuation company that bought out CPC. Look at they've advanced that company beyond... To another level as well, and that's where I think that it's wrong. So I'm quite for it. Yes, the ticks and the checks and the balances. Yes. Now let's go back as a child when I was a kid growing up in Rockhampton and in central Queensland. Look at Iwasaki. He bought that country north of Yeppoon. Now my God, it was mudflats. And look at the money he threw into that. And look what he did in that part of Australia. There is advancement, and I don't have an issue with it. If we're going to play on the global market with our agricultural products, expect that vice versa. So let's not expect other countries to purchase our products, but then we're not going to allow them to play in our backyard too. So,
fair point. Fair point, Eric. Thank you. Thank you for that. It's a fair point. Deborah, how does Australia's foreign investment scheme stack up against other countries, more comparable countries? Are we more rigorous? Are we less rigorous? Where does it fit?
Yeah, so it kind of depends on the country. But in general, a lot of the other regimes look strictly at national security. So the US, for example, used to look strictly at national security, although quite an expansive definition of what national security was. Other countries would look at more of a national benefit test, so looking more at a positive, are you actually going to improve something, or is it just, as in Australia, is it contrary to the national interest? Generally speaking, the concerns that every country is dealing with are quite similar right now.
Mm-hmm.
I was speaking at a conference last year in London and just listening to people from different jurisdictions, and we were all furiously agreeing and saying the same things about the increase in investment in agriculture, people worried about Chinese, people worried about data protection, and all of the different national interests and national security regimes evolving to address all of those concerns in quite similar ways in many cases.
Mm. Right, Deborah Johns is a partner, law partner in Gilbert and Tobin's Corporate Advisory Group, advising on corporate and commercial transactions, and expert on FIRB. We're talking about foreign investment. If you've got questions, 1-300-800-222 is the number. Well, one of my texters, Hans, says, does the FIRB advocate for a national property register? Anecdotally, the number of residential properties owned or controlled by overseas entities is understated. You say there are no really strong, really accurate figures for Chinese property investment. Is there a need for such a thing?
Yes, there is a need because there's very strong popular demand.
Mm.
In terms of actual figures, what we do have is the figures that the Foreign Investment Review Board gets for applications.
Mm-hmm.
And for those, actually, China is by far the largest group of applicants.
Right.
But that doesn't necessarily mean that they are the strongest buyers. But on the question to what extent are we protected in the sense that is there someone who controls investment and who keeps a tack on it, that's happening by the ATO, and that was introduced a few years back in response to popular concern. So in the ATO has a full register and controls who buys what residential real estate.
And you and say on average on it's about 2%, is it?
That was the total volume of Chinese real estate, mm-hmm. residential real estate purchases. Mm. China is then, apart from that, China is a player in the commercial real estate sector, but that's a commercial sector, so there's not so much concern if they buy building sites or if they buy factory sites.
So we're not going to sell our electricity grid to the Chinese. We're not going to allow them to build the 5G network in Australia either, David. Big ones like that seem to be no-brainers. What's critical infrastructure and what's not, though? What about it? What about allowing the Chinese, for example, to own another harbour crossing in Sydney, for example?
Look, it's a decision that would be made. I think that China has been allowed to buy quite a number of very significant, or Chinese interests and certainly Hong Kong interests have bought quite a number of very substantial infrastructure interests in Australia, gas pipelines, electricity distribution companies. I think there's quite a bit of investment in solar and wind farms as well, into energy. I think Deborah was saying earlier that each case is considered on its own, and that is true. Deborah, I think, also mentioned that one of the things the FIRB does is go around the different agencies and get their reactions. And although Australia's foreign investment review system is ostensibly nationality blind. You know, we don't favour one nation over another. When it comes to the reactions of the security agencies, well, that's certainly not the case. So the scene most, I guess, obviously in the decision to ban Huawei's participation in the next generation of internet infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very clear discriminatory view that basically ruled out any Chinese bidder. Now, that's not strictly through the FIRB, but it gives you an insight as to the kind of stance that the security agencies take when the FIRB asks them their opinion.
Sure. All right, Scylla, let's get some more calls. Scylla, hello. Hi, Scylla.
Yes.
Hi.
Yes, hello.
Hello. You're on.
You can hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you loud and clear. Scylla, what's your question?
I'll turn my radio off.
That's a good idea.
Yes. Okay. I've got a couple of points. Why, when superannuation was set up in Australia, weren't the companies mandated to invest in Australian companies? Why are all those billions and billions of dollars of superannuation money not buying these companies? And it, in a way, then we say there's not enough money in Australia to buy these companies. We sell them to overseas companies.
David, do you want to have a crack at this? Why?
Well,
Australian and super funds are trying to get returns for their members, I suppose.
So
that's one of the prime reasons, I guess. Yeah.
On that point, I think the United States share market has, since the global financial crisis, compared to the peak before the financial crisis hit, the US share market has doubled in value. The Australian share market is up about 15%. So if you're someone with superannuation savings, you want them to have some money in the US market. Thank you very much. It's just part of a prudent, diversified portfolio. Australian superannuation funds have a lot of money coming into them, and they are increasingly interested in funding infrastructure projects, for example. And if you look at the share registers of any of our major companies, the top 20 on pretty much all of them, you'll find, will be dominated by Australian super funds. So your super money is going into Australian companies, but it's also going offshore too. And that's as someone who looks forward to superannuation earnings, I'm very glad of that.
That's a fair point, isn't it? Isn't it, Scylla?
Okay, I want to ask another question.
Quickly.
How can Canada own water rights in Australia, and how many other countries own our water rights through that the privatisation of water?
We could ask Angus Taylor this question, I suppose, but I don't know. Does anyone want to have a crack at this? Perhaps Deborah, back to you, David. Is you the best port of call for this?
The acquisition of water rights itself is not regulated under the foreign investment legislation.
Is that right? Right.
So it could be caught because it constitutes an interest in land, or because it's part of a business.
That's very interesting, though. You're saying that.
But by itself, water is not regulated.
Is that right? So a foreign company can buy water rights in Australia, because under the Murray-Darling scheme, as we know, these things are bought and sold as assets and traded for many, many tens of millions of dollars. But they're not. They don't require FIRB approval.
Not in and of themselves. No.
Should we be surprised by that?
There has been some discussion about changing the legislation.
Sorry, Scylla.
Well, I'm saying that the foreign companies are investing in Australian water rights, and they're driving the prices up, and they're bankrupting our farmers.
Yeah, well, thanks for making the point. I think that's something that I think probably not everyone was aware of, that was the case. Is there a compelling case, Deborah, for more transparency in this whole process? Who's on the FIRB anyway? David Irvine is the boss of it. Who's on it?
I actually had scribbled out the list of names and didn't bring it with me.
That's okay, but typically who's on it?
Sure,
what sort of people?
Typically it's going to be people who, there'll be a smattering of people who have a strong business background. There's always one bureaucrat, so whoever is the head of the sort of the foreign investment division within Treasury will sit on the board. They do look for people within the business community who have specific industry sector expertise. So there's usually people from the mining sector. I don't think there is currently, but there used to be somebody from the agricultural sector. They'll look for people with strong government backgrounds as well. So that brings in an understanding of the public policy issues. So they do try to have a broad smattering of expertise within the board itself.
Yes, it does sound as though there is a compelling case for a more open and transparent process, so given that it does affect us all. What a good question was just asked. Too crazy, we need to own our Australia, says my texter. Hans, do you think the level of foreign interest from China in Australia is going to continue to increase, or where is it going?
No, it's decreasing at the moment and has decreased since about 2017.
Why?
Two reasons. One is on the Chinese side, there are restrictions on capital transfer. And that started 2016, 2017, that the Chinese put regulations in place that companies wanting to invest, either they have foreign currency in their accounts, then they can invest. If they need to acquire US dollars, for example, against their holdings in renminbi, then they need approval, and that they will only get within limits and under certain circumstances. So they would, for example, have to justify their projects. That's one reason. The other reason is that on the Chinese side there is a perception that Australia is not necessarily as welcoming as it was, mm-hmm. and that is as a result of the
Huawei decision. Not
Huawei so much by itself, but the whole range of measures we've just been talking about,
mm-hmm.
From controlling real estate investment through the ATO, from having a land register in each state. To the whole question of critical infrastructure. So there's much more supervision and much more control.
Mm.
And the cases are not necessarily clear-cut. So there's a degree of interpretation that you can have. Is something now critical infrastructure or maybe not? And there's the feeling that the overall political atmosphere is not as supportive as it used to be in the heydays, 2015-16. That's one thing. And then, of course, I think we have to look at the general global situation, where Australia is actually still doing relatively well. Investment from China in the US has plummeted and has gone negative now in the sense that Chinese companies are divesting in the United States. And same in Canada, not as severe as with the United States. And in the major European countries, we also see a decline of Chinese investment. So generally, Chinese investment is going down globally at the moment.
Matt says, Phil, question for your lawyer and the panel. As an irrigator, we're surrounded by Chinese private corporate investment, listed companies in US and Canadian pension funds. Do you think a foreign investment board cracked down on these huge investors that hide behind an Aussie front? Anyway, it's all a, won't use that language on air, Matt, but a Ponzi scheme where everything's great as long as the capital gain keeps going up. That's the only profit these guys will ever make. Well, yes, we could have a discussion about water rights, Deborah, but it's probably outside the scope of the remaining 30 seconds we have. But it's interesting that you've told us that water rights are not something that the FIRB should investigate, but maybe they should. Maybe they should. Look, thank you for your, as always, when we're into an interesting topic, time evaporates on us, but it's been terrific. Thank you for the time. Deborah Johns is from Gilbert and Tobin. Thank you, Deborah. Hans Hendrich is from the Sydney Business School. Thank you, Hans. And David, you're in. Economic commentator as well, have been our guests. Thanks to all of you, and also to our callers and texters as well.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.